Welcome to Nature Now, an original production by KPTZ volunteers. Nature Now is a program of information and insights about the natural history of our region. We welcome observations and suggestions from our listeners, care of naturenow@kptz.org.
Hello, this is Debron Kelso, host of this edition of Nature Now. This week, we are very happy to be reporting out in the field again with our guest, Dr. Fred Sharp. Welcome, Fred!
Hey, hey,
hey,
everybody.
We've been very lucky to have Fred as a guest on Nature Now several times over the past 10 years, speaking with us about everything from whale biology to birdsong. But today, we're on the beach at Fort Warden State Park, speaking about dune restoration. We're also joined by our good friend and fellow Sandy Shore lover, Meg Amos, who will be our recorder today. Welcome, Meg.
Thank you, Deborah. I'm always glad to be here.
Well, we're always glad to have you. But before we start our beach walk, let's first hear the mystery sound of the week. Isn't this an amazing call? We'll play it again at the end of the program, and Fred will tell us an interesting story about it. So, we often start our program by mentioning some of the cool things that we've been seeing out in the natural world this past week. What have you guys been noticing out there?
Well, it's all manner of migratory birds right now. We're getting close to our peak, and yellow-rump warblers, Townsend's warblers. We've got lots of black-throated grays coming through.
I've got some black-throated grays. They stay and breed in my woods.
The cool things about our avifauna, our birds, is that most of our species that migrate through, there will be representatives hanging around to breed and keep us going through song through the spring and summer. It's wonderful. We've also got three species of vireos right now, the solitary or cassins, the huttons, and the warbling vireo are all sounding off beautifully.
And I heard, now Meg has heard it before me, she lives down close to Quilcene, but I for the first time a couple of days ago heard the swainsons, the little sound that they make before, and Fred's a really great birder by ear, and he was pointing out they do a little whinny sound, and they're in the same family as the robins, and robins do that whinny sound commonly, but the swainsons did this cute little whinny sound that sounded like a little teenage robin or something.
Teenage robin or a little pony, and the swainsons are so cool because they hang out for a week or two without singing, but they're giving all their, they're on territories and they're clucking amongst each other and whinnying and doing their little. So they're lovely to have, and we have this beautiful period before they burst into full song.
I also have been hearing lately really vocal red-breasted nuthatches, and I think that they have a nesting cavity on my property. I have some great willows that are decaying and are full of great nesting cavities, and there's one just solidly calling and calling, and I bet you that it's defending a space. And that's Fred's imitation, really good imitation too, of a red-breasted nuthatch, the little yank call. But for those of you that are looking for their nesting holes, they often put pitch, like conifer pitch, around the edges of their hole to prevent predators from getting in to the eggs and young ones. So that's a cool, fun fact about them. What else have you seen? Well, actually, right out here, Betsy Carlson, that works for the Port Townsend Marine Science Center, we stopped her in the parking lot, and she said that there was a pod of orcas right out here. We just missed them. They were here about half an hour ago.
There's been an increase in the transient killer whales that have been utilizing Puget Sound with the decrease in the salmonids, but there's been marine mammals like the seals and sea lions are on the increase, and so it's lovely to have these big black and white travelers from afar.
It is indeed. Well, we should probably move on to our main topic. Fred is interested in all types of environmental restoration work, and for the last few months has become involved in helping the Lower Elwha Tsklallam Tribe and the Clallam County Conservation District in restoring dune habitat along Edis Hook. So we thought it would be fun to invite him out and learn more about that project, and also review all of the work that has been done for so long by so many closer to home at Point Wilson in Fort Worden State Park. So our radio listeners will hear the waves. We're here under the dock at the moment to get away from the rain, but we're very happy to get Fred out here on site to go on explores and introduce us to some of the plants and review some of the restoration efforts that have gone on here. And before we get into those details, we should start out with the most basic of questions, like, what is sand, Fred?
Well, sand is something to put your toes in on a sunny day and play volleyball and hang out and have picnics, and it's one of the most loveliest things about living here in Puget Sound is that we have lots and lots of glacial bluffs and depositional areas from the last ice age that give us great quantities of sand. And sand is essentially anything that's smaller than a pebble and bigger than silt, and that ranges from a couple of millimeters down to a couple widths of the human hair. And sand can be really composed of anything that's abundant and eroding. And here in our area, we have lots of sand that's been dragged down by the glaciers. So the composition of our sand is, you know, anything in Western British Columbia, Western North and Western Canada can have wound up here on our beaches as they erode. But predominantly, we have lots of basalt and sandstones in the Olympic Mountains, and those erode, and those form basically quartz, the resistant quartz crystals, the resistant quartz little bits of sand. Those are very common here. Essentially, it's silicon dioxide, which is glass, and so sand is used very heavily by humans, and it's also a really important habitat down here. And you can see there's lots of bits of broken clamshell and crab shells, and so sand can also be composed organically from living things, and so it's really quite diverse composition.
So how did most of it get here?
It comes in from the rivers. We've got many magnificent rivers that surround the Olympic Peninsula, so a lot of the sand comes washed down from the eroding Olympic Mountains. We also have this, you know, hundreds if not thousands of feet of this mantle of unconsolidated glacial sediments that those are constantly being eroded and moving around. And it's all of our glacial bluffs that surround the Quimper Peninsula here. If you look at them, you can see those are composed of unconsolidated, often compact, but relatively easy to erode. And so wave action, wherever you have significant wind and wave, the bluffs are constantly eroding. Essentially, we have these really cool rivers of sand. It's like a moving sand ecosystem. I mean, rivers don't stop flowing when they hit the sea. They just transition into the ocean, but there's still lots of movement of waters and currents, and the sand gets moved around with longshore transport. And it's really cool. Areas here like Point Wilson, the sand here is moved into this site basically from winds coming up through Port Townsend Bay and Oak Harbor, and also this would be southerly winds pushing it to the north, but we also have significant westerly winds here in the Straits of Juan de Fuca. That pushes these westerly winds push it to the east, and we get this beautiful projection of Point Wilson in one of the most cool dune areas here from all the sand that collects here from wind and wave.
And you were telling me an amazing fact about how sand is the most heavily used natural resource in the world after water.
Yeah, isn't that crazy? You find sand being used in all kinds of human endeavors. And of course, that includes asphalt and cement and glass and concrete, but it's also found in abrasives. It's used extensively in agriculture. People put sand in their aquaria. It's used industrially for sandblasting and in bricks and in fracking and abrasives and paints and sand casting and sandbags. It's put into filters, and of course, I love it in my sandbox. But it's an incredible amount of, what is it, 40 million tons are used annually around the world, and it's just like, and it's actually running out. I mean, believe it or not, it's like there is a huge looming sand shortage in the world, and that most of the commercially exploitable deposits, which are often taken from rivers and depositional basins, flatlands, estuaries, and not all sand is created equal. Believe it or not, Saudi Arabia, which is mostly composed of sand dunes, actually has to import virtually all their sand because sand that's blown around by wind has different, oftentimes it's much smaller, it's much finer, it tends to be much more rounded. It doesn't have the angularity that gives it much of the structure that we use in cements and asphalts.
Oh, that's really interesting. I never thought about that before. Never realized that there was a difference.
And of course, there's huge environmental costs. You know, it always seems like a good idea initially for the exploitation, and but once you start removing sand, it can increase coastal erosion. Sand is really important substrate for rivers and estuaries. There's all kinds of organisms that live in the estuary and on the beaches, clams and cockles, and it's super important for eelgrass. And so once we start removing...
Deposition of eggs for the forage fish.
Absolutely, yeah. Deposition for eggs for forage fish and... gray whales, they come and feed extensively on sandy and silty beaches. They feed by sucking up large amounts of actually the substrate into their mouth with their, what we call their buccal cavity. It's like a big trick-or-treat bag made out of spandex. That swells up. Then they blow the sandy, muddy material through their baleens and retain the prey. So it's like so many things. Organisms evolve to what's kind of always been here, and then humans show up and we start moving sand around, taking out of its environment, and suddenly we have extensive erosion problems. And so the looming sand crisis, and there's still lots of sand around, but it's under cities now, or it's places that are environmentally sensitive. And so like so many things, it's just a supply shortage, but not here, not today at beautiful Fort Worden.
That's right. So, would you please review the history of the Point Wilson Conservation Project for us?
Well, there's few protected places in Puget Sound that have such large areas of sandy coastal beaches with such a rich and diverse flora here as at Point Wilson. And it's particularly amazing because as an earlier military base with a wide variety of manipulations has happened along the beachfront, yet astonishingly, the native plants have prevailed. And it was recognized as a special treasure by the late Olympic Peninsula botanical researcher Nelsa Buckingham in the 80s and early 90s. And the conservation of Point Wilson has been ongoing for years with the removal of scotch broom and other invasive weeds. And of course, the increasing popularity of the park has put considerable pressure on these plant communities as the number of additional trails accessing the beach has increased every year. This damages the native plant community because the sandy soil is very susceptible to the disturbance that foot traffic creates. In 2006, members of the Olympic Peninsula chapter became aware of this and formed the Point Wilson Conservation Work Group. A work plan was created focusing on areas of highest habitat value, and the Washington State Parks was approached for cooperation. A conservation grant was obtained from the Washington Native Plant Society with additional funds from the Friends of Fort Worden. And there's been tons of people involved in this effort, and those that I know best have been from the Washington Native Plant Society, including Forrest Schomer, Sharon and Bob Schlechter, Dixie and Dave Llewellyn, Fred and Ann Weinman, and Wendy McClear. And the Friends of Fort Worden have also been very active in supporting this project in the past few years. And in fact, they were recently recognized as the 2021 Volunteer Group of the Year by Washington State Parks. And it's crazy, but their efforts have included removal of 9,000 pounds of scotch broom.
Wow.
Yeah, scotch broom fears these conservationists, I'll tell you. Along with over 1,000 cubic yards of invasive spurge laurel and lots of poison hemlock. I've been only on a few of the work parties myself, but have seen the remarkable changes that we'll be sauntering through shortly. And it's especially amazing to see how some of the native plants can bounce back once they stop being trampled by well-intentioned but unwitting visitors looking for a shortcut to the water.
Yeah, it's a cool thing what they've done here. And I think that the three-part plan that they developed included, like, one, protection of the sandy coastal area along the beach from further degradation, two, control of invasive species, and three, the restoration of impacted and eroded areas. So let's get out from under this pier and go look at some examples of these conservation measures. Yeah. On our wander over here to look at some of the signage and some of the areas that are cordoned off now to force traffic into a pattern where they're not trampling vegetation, we ended up hearing a killdeer calling, and it's one of the most common species that we hear in the sandy dunes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they like to nest out here. They have their eggs that look like little stones, little pebbles. Whenever Debron wants something from me, she does her little broken wing display, just like the like the killdeer. Yeah, so they're a master of deception. The parents are really good at pulling the interest of a potential predator away from the eggs. And you know, they're a great example of a bird that really likes and needs these types of open habitats. The killdeers are, you know, they're pretty common, and they actually do pretty well in humanized areas. They can nest up on big roofs or, you know, stony, big open parking lots and areas, but they do best out here in these open areas. And you know, it's good to remember that, you know, one of the problems of modern times is that we have brought so many introduced plants with us that open, blowing, sandy substrates are pretty infrequent now, and that's why the work here at Fort Worden is so important, because by removing invasive plants like the Scotch broom and the spurge and the cheatgrasses and the poison hemlock, it keeps these sites open for species like the killdeer and tiger beetles. And our sandy ecosystems on the outer coast, there's another important species out there, the snowy plover, that's been...
They've really been hammered, right? I mean, are they considered endangered?
They definitely have had some special status in the state and along the Pacific coast because, well, we do like our off-road vehicles.
Yeah.
just trampling and cats and dogs and all manner of ills from modern living has been tough on the snowy plovers. But sometimes you've been out on the open coast and you'll notice that there's these closure areas during the breeding season, and those have definitely helped.
Yep. Well, and also as we were wandering over here, we're seeing some cool plants. Do you want to?
Yes.
Are these native species here?
Yes, it's so lovely. We've come across one of our more common native species. It's this beautiful little beach knotweed with the beautiful pink and white flowers. And this is in that really big family of the knotweeds. It has all the little bracts. And these plants out here are really hardy. I mean, this is a tough place to make a living. Out here in the open dunes, sand is characterized by very, very rapid high porosity, very rapid drainage. So typically dune plants have really deep roots or large tap roots. The foliage is often kind of tough. Our little knotweed here, it's almost like conifer needles.
Yeah.
And conifer needles, you know, they're basically here in the Northwest, we've got our very dry summers and wet winters. So during the summer months, oftentimes by having these very waxy looking leaves with the stomata on the areas where they exchange the gases on the undersides of the leaves helps protect them. Oftentimes, you know, beach plants they're silvery or have hairs that are good for reflecting light, reducing the desiccating wind velocities around the leaves. This plant grows in nice little dense clumps, kind of pin cushioning, which is also another strategy for minimizing the amount of water loss on these sunny days. And right now everything is blooming out here. So yeah, be sure to come on out and enjoy these beautiful little blossoms. Sort of white and pink. They almost look like a candy almost, with the pink, beautiful pink stripes. And this one's nice because it doesn't have any defensive bristles or hairs or spines or anything. So beautiful to see it growing out here in this restored area.
What about this little, it looks almost like a little clover. No, yeah. It is.
This is our little yellow hop clover. It is an introduced species, pretty widespread, but relatively...
It doesn't take over.
Yeah. Now, one that's very problematic over much of Western North America is the cheatgrass. You can see it coming up here pretty abundantly.
What are the distinctive characteristics of it?
The cheatgrass, it has these very long, sharp spikelets that come out. You know when you're hiking around in dry grassy areas?
And you get your socks full of these little spears. That's usually cheatgrass in this type of environment.
It's pretty nutritious right now for livestock and wild animals. But as it dries out, these little spears, they get super pointed, and they can be problematic for like coyotes, and they can get in their ears, they can get in your pet's ears. Have this long little, almost like a sharp little bristle, about an inch long, that comes off the back of what we call the spikelet, and those have been found, and they can get stuck in the eyes of birds of prey, and so. It's one of the most abundant aggressive grasses, and the problem is when it dries out, it gets very sharp and it loses a lot of its forage value and can diminish the quality of rangeland. So.
And it also is carried about readily.
Yes, exactly.
Yep.
Exactly.
Is this also called foxtail?
The foxtail barley, it's different, but it's quite similar in that also the head of the grass as it dries out and shatters, it can also be problematic for your socks and for wildlife.
And dog's toes.
Yep.
Well, let's take a wander down this trail. Oh, look at this. This looks like a little lupin.
A little beach lupin.
Yeah.
Here we see this gorgeous little beach lupin.
There are the silver hairs that you're talking about.
Silvery reflective hairs, low growing to the ground. Very... Oh, it's already seeded. It has its cute little pea pods.
Oh, that is
glorious.
Darling
little beach lupin here. And another fantastic native.
Oh, and I am seeing that we're running out of time. We're so glad that we have you for part two next month, but... Before we let you go, we want to hear that mystery sound again. And it's the sound of a burrowing owl. And we chose the variant that you hear that rattling call. And it's apparently, and I had no idea that they did this. I got this recording from the Cornell Ornithology Lab, which has fabulous recordings of all different types of calls of different species. And this one they described as the rattling call. And apparently burrowing owls make the sound to ward off predators because they often share the habitat with rattlesnakes. So they make this rattling call so that predators won't go into their burrows thinking that it's a rattlesnake. So anyway, it is genius. But you have a great story about burrowing owls from this very area, don't you, Fred?
Yeah, it was probably 20 years ago, and it was in fall migration, and I was out here bird watching, and lo and behold, it looked like a coyote den. A burrowing owl popped up out of it, and they're so cool. They have those long legs, and they kind of stand upright, and those luminous yellow eyes, and all those little bows and bobs and little cluckings and little rattling sounds that they make. And it was like, man, that's fantastic to see them in this habitat. And we don't get them much here these days, but we know from the old records of the early naturalists that the burrowing owls, they used to nest on islands in Grays Harbor. There's evidence they may have nested out on the Quileute Prairie and possibly could have extended their range, their breeding range, over in this area too. So it's lovely to have them come through, and it's precisely these types of restoration programs that increased habitat quality that one day we may have their little cluckings and rattles breeding back in this wonderful habitat.
We can hope for that. As an aside, Meg and I just came back from Malheur National Wildlife Refuge, and we saw burrowing owls on a hillock and doing the little bobbing. So they were probably defending a nest. And I was just over the moon to see them. They're just so, so darling. And we hope that they come back to this area again. So thanks so much to Meg and to Fred for joining me on this rainy afternoon. That's it for our show, but tune back in next month and we'll have part two.
Thanks everyone.
Thank
We're
you.
Bobbling and cordling. Goodbye.
And closing, speaking of bobbing and cordling, closing music today is Good Vibrations from the Beach Boys.
Yeah, let's get out.
Perfect.
Where's the ice chest and the volleyball net, people?
I love the colorful clothes she wears and the way the sunlight plays upon her hair. I hear the sound of a gentle wind on the wind that lifts her perfume through the air. I'm picking up good vibrations. She's giving me the excitations. I'm picking up good vibrations. She's giving me smile. Softly smile, I know she must be kind.